You have a responsibility not only to protect yourself, but you almost have a societal moral responsibility to protect other people.
Greetings. This is Earl Jones, your host of the Jazz Horizon Show, featured every Thursday from 2 until 4 p.m. with a wide variety of jazz music, not only of those jazz artists of the past, but also those artists that are new on the horizon. I also especially enjoy showcasing the latest sounds of Detroit's jazz artists as well. So if you would like to join me for a lovely day, then tune in every Thursday from 2 until 4 p.m. right here at WHFR.FM and the station that's making waves with yours truly, Earl Jones, and the Jazz Horizon Show.
Hi, this is Terrence of the Play It By Ear Show, heard every Sunday from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Want to wish all of our loyal listeners a fantastic Thanksgiving Turkey Day. Come on, come on, come on, come on.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the WHFR Journal. My name's Alan Mazurek here with Susan McGraw. Hope you have had a happy Thanksgiving, that specifically for our listeners and to you, Susan, as well. Did you have a good day?
Thank you. It was wonderful, Alan. A little non-traditional meal, but enjoyed it very much. I'm not a I shouldn't say this the day after Thanksgiving. Not such a turkey person. I'm not going to lie on that. But I know that people are enjoying leftovers and kind of laying around today with the campus being closed for the weekend and lots of businesses closed. It's a nice time to sort of regroup and reconnect with family. And I loved it. And I hope yours was nice as well.
I got sent home with a lot of leftovers, and some of them did involve turkey as well. So, while we are, you know, doing our journal today, I'll have to put my fork down eventually. And, you know, anyway. So, all right. So we're here this Friday. There's a lot of things going on here at the Henry Ford College campus as we wrap up the end of this semester. And we really want to sort of, spend some time talking about some actually number one, important, and number two, interesting things going on here on campus. So we're going to have a very interesting segment here. Actually, coming up later in the second half of our program, we'll have another special. We'll talk about that a little bit later on, but let's dive into it today. So what do we have today, Susan?
Alan, we are so excited to have some representatives from the upcoming theater presentation of The Passage, which takes place next weekend, the 1st through the 4th of December. And also, we have joining us today a representative from Student Activities and the Hawk's Nest, because these two entities are partnering for a wonderful cause. And we're just so excited to have live theater back on campus and to do something really positive in the process of experiencing something really positive. It is a win-win. It is absolutely a win-win. We are excited to welcome some representatives directly from the play. Now, we're talking about The Passage. If you've been listening to WHFR as of late, you've been hearing us promote it, of course. We had the new theater director of Henry Ford College, Dr. John Michael Saffell, on a couple months back when we welcomed him officially, but he has been a busy bee, I'll tell you, and so has everyone involved in this production. It is called The Passage. It's by Robert Lawson, and it really is a retelling of Herman Melville's traditional Moby Dick fish story, if you will, and with a twist, let's put it that way. And joining us today to talk about the play, a little bit of the background of it, and what we can expect when we come see it, hopefully on campus Thursday through Sunday of next week. It goes Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 8 o'clock p.m., and then on Sunday there's a matinee at 2 right here on the Dearborn main campus of Henry Ford College on Evergreen Road. So joining us today on the live Zoom line is the choreographer of the play, Shauna Ray Hazimi. And we have one of the stars, yes, I'm saying it, stars of the play, one of the main characters from both the novel and the play, and that is Courtney Collins. And Courtney is playing Ishmael. In addition, we have the wonderful Mandy Earle joining us from the Hawk's Nest, our ever popular and always necessary food pantry here through Henry Ford College. So excited to dive in and talk with all of you. And this is sort of a retelling. This is a production that is, when Dr. Seffel said he was going to do the passage, and he's juggling 16 different things right now, as we know, if you've gotten to know him, the man does not rest and he aims big. And the passage is no exception. I mean, this is a big story with a big point and lots and lots and lots of bells and whistles in this play. So he came in and he said, I'm going to do HSC Theater proud. Oh, that's happening in a big way. So Courtney and Shauna Ray, we're so happy to have you representing the play. And Mandy, thank you for being here as well. Great to see you all today.
Thank you.
Well, let's start off with Shauna and Courtney and see number one. All right. We as Susan has mentioned, this is kind of a retelling of the Moby Dick story, which we assume most people know. What's different about it? how does this work? And what is the intention in terms of what this play is compared to the, you know, historical story?
What's different about this portrayal in this play, I would say, is obviously, you know, that's a very long novel, and this play has kind of taken the moments that are most important to the storytelling and portraying them in a way that is definitely more camp and fun in moments. And I think the way that it's set up is it's telling the story in like slower, serious moments contrasting with faster camp fun moments. And that doesn't happen as much in the storytelling in the original novel. And yeah.
So how long have both of you been involved with the theater program, and what has the experience been so far in terms of getting this play on the stage and ready to go a week from now? Either of you. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I've been involved with Henry Ford's theater program since I was a child. I started out with Mary Bremer. And I met Chris Bremer, who is part of the theater still, through that. So she kind of took me under her wing. And the first time I performed on the Henry Ford stage was when I was like 12. And I just thought, how amazing, what an amazing opportunity. And I didn't realize what an actually amazing opportunity it was until I grew older. And I came back for college and I did a year here, and I just saw all of the things that I wanted the theater to be and continue to grow to be and have the community of people come together for. And so that's why I keep coming back. And it's been a long time coming. As we all know, COVID happened, mm-hmm. and theater was put on hold. And I know for any person who's involved in the arts of any type, music, theater, dance, it was really hard on us. And it's really, really nice to be back in our home and our environment and creating with each other, hopefully a production that people will connect to.
So these performances, they're going to take place in the Adre Auditorium. Is that correct?
Yes. It'll be in Adre Auditorium. I think it's building F.
Yes.
And then so
right now, yeah.
and so for Courtney, coming in your first production, or have you had other productions under your belt here?
I've had other productions. I started off in, I believe it was 2019, for Mary Poppins. Shauna and I did that together. And I've done that show. We were so close to performing Mamma Mia, and that was cut short by COVID. And so that didn't happen. And that was directed by Chris Bremer. And then we just, last year did Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. And now this is my fourth show here, technically.
Wow. What role did you play in Five Women?
I played Meredith. She was the star.
Yeah. I remember you from that play. That was wild. Yeah,
it was wild.
And I think what was most exciting was really just being back in the theater, you know, with other people, enjoying a live production, because we missed it so much. We have been sort of interim here in keeping the theater going since our former theater director, Dr. George Popovich, retired. And we, you know, the Bremers have been great patrons of this community, this campus community, and our theater as well. But coming in with a pro that we have found in Dr. Seffel, that's got to be quite an experience. And I, you know, I already just, he's just wonderful, and we've just known each other for a short time. So working with him so directly has got to be an experience. What's it like? What's different about him? We can talk about him because he's not here. So what's different about working with somebody new and kind of learning the ropes of what, you know, give and take and what expectations are?
We have so much to say about Dr. John Michael. We love him. He's absolutely incredible. Just such a kind-hearted soul and person. For him to come here fresh to the state and pick up how he has and advocated for the students in the manner he has and really try to integrate the cultural aspect of our community into the theater like he has, it's something I haven't seen before. And it was really refreshing. And I actually got emotional with him when he first came in, because it like a breath of fresh air. We were worried about the theater for a while. Like you said, we were an interim with the theater, and I can't imagine a more perfect person to come in and lead this group.
Yeah, I agree full-heartedly. Even just knowing him in this short amount of time in the process so far, he's already added so many wonderful things to me, just as a human and as an actor. I really think it is super effective to have somebody who cares as much as he does being in charge of things, because it really influences the energy of the entire community to get on that level too. And I've seen so many good things already from him being here.
Well, speaking of external energy and serving the community, this is a very unique partnership that we kind of want to talk about today, which involves the Hawk's Nest here at Henry Ford College. And that's why Mandy Earle is here with us on today's meeting. From what I read, the Theater Arts Department and the Hawk's Nest are having what I think is a wonderful and maybe first time collaboration that I know of as part of their food drive for the fall production of The Passage. Mandy Earle, who is involved with student activities here at Henry Ford College, and also very essential for the operations of the Hawk's Nest. Why don't you explain a little bit about that to us?
Well, the Hawk's Nest is a student food pantry on campus here that's available to any of the students that are currently enrolled in at least one credit hour. And we rely on donations. So we completely run on donations. So this is such a wonderful collaboration. And we're so thankful and grateful to Dr. Seffel and the theater department for coming up with this wonderful idea. And Alan, like you mentioned, this is the first time, at least since I've been here, that we've ever done this type of collaboration.
Yeah, I didn't know it for a fact, but yeah. I was sort of guessing first I'd heard. And it seems like a very unique one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so we are very excited to partner with the theater department to hold this donation, but also to help spread the word about this amazing production that's going to take place next week. So we are also helping to get the word out there and let the HFC students, faculty, and staff know that if you bring at least two non-perishable items to whichever night or the afternoon show that you want to come to, you will get half off your admission. So I believe that's going to be $3.50 for you to come watch an amazing production here on campus. So you can't beat that, and then also doing a great thing to help out our students as well.
It's the best Black Friday deal that's going on.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, no doubt. I know some deals, so let me just tell you. No, this, it really is a win-win. And remember, again, open to students, HFC students, employees, faculty, staff, and you can purchase tickets in advance, and that's the plan, that's the goal, mm-hmm. to go ahead and go to our website, hfcc.edu, just search The Passage, you'll see that information there, talks about how to actually go about doing that. There's a code that you enter and so on. Mm-hmm. but it's worth $350. And more importantly, it's helping our campus community. You know, that's what it's all about. You are welcome to still bring canned goods or donations for the Hawk's Nest. If you are a non-HFC student or employee, I'm sure they will be welcomed at the door. Certainly, the discount is applicable for students, faculty, and staff here at HFC with advance tickets. But we're hoping that this is going to start a trend for continuing to incorporate a variety of different areas of the campus. I know that another aspect of what's so wonderful about Dr. John Michael is his collaboration in reaching out to other departments, even for support for the actual production part of the play, working with ceramics, with graphic design, with music, and with our area of telecommunication or the media arts. We're really proud and excited to say that this really is a campus production. I mean, this is not just a theater production. And boy, that he's pretty wise, isn't he? That buy-in, understanding what that can do for the morale of kind of bringing this theater program back to its full potential. And we're getting there, aren't we? This is so exciting.
Yes, we are.
Good stuff.
Shana, I just want to comment on the tickets and stuff, because even if you aren't, like you said, Susan, if you aren't a staff member or a student at Henry Ford, tickets for general admission are still only $12. And that is a steal, too. You can barely get that for a movie ticket now. And if you are a student and you don't happen to have two non-perishable items, your tickets are going to be $7. But if you have those two non-perishables, you get your tickets in advance online, you use the code. I believe the code is C-HawksNest, and you put that in the coupon code. You'll immediately get 50% off your ticket, bring those two non-perishables with you, and you are golden for $350. It's a steal of a deal.
Yeah. Spoken like a true choreographer. You completely choreographed that well there. Well,
I was going to ask about that. Now, I don't necessarily have sea legs, but I think of the Moby Dick tale and ship, and I see choreography. I don't do a lot of dancing when I'm on deck of a ship. I grew up on sailboats and stuff like that. What does choreography mean when it comes to this production?
Okay, so it was a strange one to get with, because a straight play normally does not have choreography or dance movement with it. This is a play that wants to be a musical so bad. And it kind of goes in tandem with what Courtney was saying earlier, that it takes the most important parts of the story, Moby Dick, consolidates that, and adds a layer of campiness to it. So it brings in the fun. And with that comes a little bit more movement. So we worked a lot with, there are a couple sing-songy things that the cast have to go through. And with that are steps. It's a little bit easier to sing-songy when you have a few steps to work with your body. And so just things like that, simple movement that we don't even think about every day. We just use our bodies because we use them like robots. But when you actually sit down to think about it, you're like, oh, wait, I'm dancing every day in my everyday life. I dance all the time. And so just to bring that awareness to the cast and really be appreciative of what our bodies can do for us, whether or not we're full out dancing or if it's slight movement because we need a certain cue to get the rope over the ship, whatever it may be, it's still movement and you still have to get it on point with the timing of everything.
Right. And it's a 2-hour production, we're told. Yes. About 2 hours.
We are working with the timing. We're trying to keep it an hour. We're not sure if we will be able to have an intermission. So we're trying to keep it within a decent time span for people to sit for the entire period without feeling antsy and I have to get out of here. It's a great production. It's super fun. It's silly. It doesn't make sense. It makes sense with serious notes. It's everything the human condition gives you.
I'm going to take a liberty here and I'm going to read something from our website that is promoting the passage, if you don't mind. And what I think is most exciting is sort of this whole, it's like a holistic multimedia kind of a thing going on. It literally is very non-traditional. So as it says on our HFC website, this production uses music, dance, puppets, and film to tell the tale of Captain Ahab's obsession with the white whale called Moby Dick, seen through the perspective of Ishmael, a young sailor on his first whaling voyage. Unlike Melville's novel, which takes place primarily at sea, this fast-paced, what you're talking about, Shauna, play explores the realities of those on board the whaling ship, as well as those they leave behind on shore. So this is going to it's going to be something unlike we've seen probably in our traditional theater here at Henry Ford and in general terms. You talked about campy, you talked about silly and fun, but not necessarily a full family event, correct? Just speak to that just a little bit. We want to make sure that we have the right audience coming in for this.
Yes, this is not necessarily a full family show. This is not a children's show. There are silly moments, there are campy moments, but it's not for children. This show deals with a lot of important yet adult topics. And I feel like the adults will understand the message here, and the children, it'll go over their heads and they might be even scared. And we don't want to scare the children. We want to invite the children in. I'm sure we'll do other shows that are more family friendly, but for the first start, this is how we're starting. And, I think that it's really geared towards a mature audience.
Yeah, so some mature themes, we'll say.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, got it. I've been peeking at some of the rehearsals, so I'm not going to lie, and also involved with the video creation and so on. And it is just, this looks wild. I'm telling you, a couple of my students are in it and so excited, and they come out of rehearsals, what I've seen, exhausted, but so happy and so excited to be a part of this. And you mentioned about tweaking the timing and so on and so forth. This is live theater. It literally is a work in progress up until you step onto that stage on Thursday at 8 p.m. So who knows what could happen between now and then, right?
Even then, when you step on that stage Thursday, you're still unsure what's going to happen on that stage.
Right. All bets are off.
So it's just the cast up there. They've worked so hard. I'm so proud of all of them. It's just the production team, the casting crew. We really came together for this.
It's obvious. We can tell. Chris Bremer is technical director, I understand, for this one. So there are going to be some familiar names, familiar faces as well. But we certainly are inviting our entire population, our listening community, to come out to Dearborn, to the Henry Ford College, and experience this live theater like you have not seen in a long time on our campus, and like you may have never seen before based on this interpretation called The Passage. John Michael had indicated a robust theater schedule, basically, for forthcoming events as well. He's already got a production in January that he's working on, Tenderly. 5 a.m. Pancakes will be coming in January as well. And then in April, She Kills Monsters will be coming to our stage also. So that's sort of that juggling that I was talking about. But so wonderful to see what's going to be, I think, the fruits of a lot of people's labor put forth in this event. And we're so excited to be a part of sharing it with our community. Mandy, in the context of collecting food donations for the Hawk's Nest, are there specific things that you, in this current food drive and accessories drive, that you're looking for? Anything, any seeds you want to plant here for what we should bring in to participate?
Yeah, so any non-perishable is wonderful to get. A few items that we probably need a little more of. As we go into the colder months, we tend to have more requests for like the soups and the chilies, like the Chef Boyardee canned items. And then we always need canned fruit. We try to also provide lots of healthy things there too as well, so fruit and vegetables. So canned fruit is a big one that we don't get a ton of. For canned vegetables, we love getting that. We are overstocked with corn and green beans right now. So please, any other vegetable would be wonderful. And then always like snack items too, just so the students, when they're here on campus, also have something they can kind of snack on and keep them going throughout the day, like granola bars, like mixed peanut packets, crackers and peanut butter, those types of things as well.
And Mandy, I know we've talked about this on previous editions of the WHFR Journal. For students who may find themselves in that position where they need that help, what what that first step is, how they connect with you, where they need to go, and what that first step is.
Yeah, so right now we are kind of operating under a appointment-only schedule, simply because I'm trying to find student staff still and get that all situated to where we can be a little more open. But all they need to do is email us at hawksnest@hawkmail.hsdc.edu. Just send an email to that and just say, hey, I need to get some food. And then we'll respond to you, get you registered, and get you set up with your appointment.
And what go ahead, please go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Shauna.
If people want to donate canned goods and they're not going to come see the show for whatever reason, and they I know, right? Why wouldn't they see the show? They should. But like, if I wanted to bring you canned goods, if people from the theater wanted to bring canned goods, because I know we want to support and help, where would we bring those? What building will we bring it to? Should we just leave it in the theater for you? What do you think?
So we always are collecting food on campus, whether there's a food drive going on or not. So we have some donation boxes set up across campus. One of them is right outside the Hawk's Nest door, which is in building L138. There is a box there. We have one in the campus safety building, which is building N in the lobby. And then we also have one at the Welcome Center, which is on the main floor of the Welcome Center at the end of that main hallway. And then the Student Activities Office in the Student Center building M105. We always collect food there as well. And I do also do like pickups across campus. So I know like certain offices have bins in their office. And then once it starts to get full, they just let me know and we come pick it up. So if that was something like the theater department wanted to do, we could do that as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Shauna Ray, your new co-host for the WHFR Journal, Susan. Excellent question. Absolutely. It has been so great to talk to you. And obviously at this time of year, heading into the holidays, Mandy, I assume that, you know, the need is as great as ever. Not even bringing up all of the issues we've talked about, you know, over the past few years when it comes to COVID. But, what has the demand been as far as, you know, what the students need in order to be able to succeed and achieve their goals? And one more time in terms of, you know, what the need is, I guess.
So we're kind of starting to see that more and more students are coming back to using it. Now that we're coming back on campus. So that need is going to continue to grow. And also with the inflation, prices going up on everything, that makes it even harder for students and people that may not have even been struggling before and now find themselves in a different position. And so we'd like to, especially this time of year, we like to, as we head into winter break, try to be able to give them more food than maybe they typically would get on their usual visits, just because we're going to be closed during that winter break. So being able to have a couple of drives right now that are bringing in the extra food is going to mean a lot for us to be able to give them more stuff to be able to help them through those few weeks that the pantry will be closed.
Thank you so much for that support. And we know firsthand that students are truly benefiting from it. So we appreciate it being here and being accessible. And also we appreciate our listeners for doing what they can to support. And I know cash donations or, you know, online card donations are available as well through our foundation office. Simply earmark the funds for the Hawk's Nest when you make a contribution through the HFC Foundation. Shauna Ray Hazimi, choreographer for The Passage. Courtney Collins, one of the main characters of Ishmael in this play, and Mandy Earle, our Hawk's Nest coordinator and member of our student activities team. This has just been a pleasure getting to chat with you. We wish you much success in this. We thank you for your time, and also thanks to Dr. John Michael Savell for doing what he's done to contribute so far and create this buzz on campus and in the community about this first play. Please come out and support it. Support the theater program. Support The Passage, and we know that you will be rewarded with lots of excitement for doing so.
And to tie things up, yeah, the HFC Theater Arts Department and the Hawk's Nest are in the midst of what is a truly great collaboration on the food drive, which has been ongoing for the Hawk's Nest for what, Mandy, the last, what, month or so? But tying it into the HFC fall production of The Passage, which, of course, runs next weekend in the Andrei Auditorium. HFC students and employees are invited to bring two non-perishable pantry items to the box office on the nights of the show for 50% off your ticket price. You can find more information by going to hfcc.edu, which is, of course, the college's website. There will be somewhere up there in the news section or the other news section, you'll be able to find it anyway. Or you can go to the HFC Theater website, get your ticket, book your ticket, and then obviously put together the fact that you're going to bring in some food donations and do something good and see something good. I guess sounds good. Sounds good.
Hey? Break a leg. Enjoy the show.
Do something good. See something good. Sounds good. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the WHFR Journal. We got to move on to the next segment. I was going to tell you about it, but it's just going to come up next. Anyway, hopefully everyone's having a great holiday weekend, and we'll be back to see you next week with more on the WHFR Journal.
Vision loss is not something that you feel until it happens.
Most people lose their vision from diseases like macular degeneration and glaucoma. Not at birth.
3 million Americans have glaucoma, and half don't even know it.
11 million people in the United States have macular degeneration.
So many eye disorders can be treated if caught early.
Make a plan today to get your eyes checked.
Visit brightfocus.org to learn more.
It's that time of year when Turkey Day is approaching. Construction paper turkeys grace classroom walls. Thanksgiving menus are being meticulously planned, and children of all ages are making the trek back home. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we delve into the myths and truths of the wild turkey. We even talk with an extraordinary man who learned to be a turkey mother.
Day after day, for over a year, I saw no one except my family. It was a family like none that you know. But I'm a mother, it seems, and these are my children. And soon enough, like all children, they'll leave home, and I suppose my heart will be broken. But for now, this is my life as a turkey.
We'll talk with Joe Hutto in a moment. But first, some myth-busting. There's a story Benjamin Franklin wanted the national bird to be the turkey rather than the bald eagle. While that's not true, it is true that Franklin called the bald eagle a bird of bad moral character, and he admired the wild turkey for being, as he wrote to his daughter, a much more respectable bird and withal a true original native of America. Another turkey myth is that the bird can't fly. It's true that domestic turkeys are too heavy to fly, but wild turkeys can fly up to 55 miles per hour. With Good Reason producer Allison Quantz reports that even pilots have an appreciation for turkey flight.
If you've ever stopped to watch a hawk wheel and turn through the sky, you can imagine that pilots might find inspiration in birds. Captain Eric Walden is a fourth-generation pilot, and there's one bird that he's taken note of.
It's very difficult to find them, especially when you're looking for them. You can stalk around in the woods and fields all day long and never find a single one.
Walden is talking, of course, about wild turkeys.
The flying part is always stunning, because you think there's no way these animals are going to fly away, and the whole flock will take flight in the middle of a dense forest and disappear.
A wild turkey can weigh over 20 pounds. That's about as heavy as a car tire.
You'd imagine the legs that can move something like that at high speed and with a high level of agility. They don't just run in a straight line, but they jink and turn and leap over obstacles and move very fast while they're doing it. the size of the legs. When you, if you ever been to a county fair or something like that, you have turkey legs for sale, and the thing looks like it came off a dinosaur. You know, it's 18 inches long and 6 inches around and weighs, you know, 5 pounds. So those are the legs.
And those big chunky legs make sense, because turkeys spend most of their lives on the ground. But sometimes they have to fly in order to live.
Flying is a tool that they use to escape and move short distances.
It's that moment of transition from ground to air that Walden finds particularly remarkable. And I'm going to let him take it from here. So close your eyes, put yourself in the middle of a field or forest, and imagine a car tire sprouting wings.
These big fat wings come out of the side of the body and just start pummeling the ground. Grass and leaves and branches flying all over the place, and they're all doing it simultaneously. And then somebody trips and has to get up. They're in this dash to reach flight velocity, but the first several beats of the wings, they're grasping at the air. So it looks like they're barely going to make it. And as a pilot, I can relate to that. The first few moments after liftoff, you're the most exposed. You're close to the ground, you're at low speed, you have very few options. So if the turkey at this point comes across an obstacle it can't clear, there's going to be a crash. But the legs tuck into the body, and all of a sudden he's transformed into an aerial ninja. They can fly through a tight forest on a steep hill in between trees, either turning sideways, knife edge, or actually tucking their wings together and shooting in between two trees like a feathered missile. And on the other side, unfurling those big fat wings to execute a 90-degree turn, probably pulling as many G's as an F-22 fighter pilot in an aggressive maneuver. Using those legs so they can bounce off of trees, bounce off of the ground, do like a half flight, half running dance, I suppose. But it's not really a dance because it looks ridiculous. The transition from flight to ground is as unceremonious. They don't come in and flutter and alight softly upon the ground. They basically pick a spot, they crash to the ground, sliding through the grass and the leaves. But they hop right back up. They're tough birds. And they pop those periscope necks up and take a look around. And if everything looks good to go, then they just go back to being a ground-based bird.
For With Good Reason, I'm Allison Quance. Coming up next, contrary to popular belief, wild turkeys are intelligent. And they're born with an incredible genetic blueprint of their natural world. My next guest is Joe Hutto. He lived for 2 years raising a rafter of wild turkeys who all thought he was their mother. He also spent 9 years living with a herd of mule deer and becoming an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker along the way. Joe Hutto is a wildlife artist, ethologist, and author. Joe, you wrote and illustrated the incredible book, Illumination in the Flatwoods, which was later turned into My Life as a Turkey. It's about the 2 years you spent as a turkey mother. How'd you get to be a turkey mother?
Well, I got the eggs. Turkey hens, when they're sitting on their nest, they actually talk to their eggs. And so I actually did that. I would try to talk to the eggs and turkey. I understood a little wild turkey vocabulary. And so I'd make little turkey-like sounds, and it was amazing. When they hatched, they absolutely knew who I was.
Can you give me a little bit of turkey sound?
No.
I mean, you can't. You
absolutely
can't.
Not. No. No, I'm not going on radio and television and make turkey noises. Yeah. You know, the truth is that I got very good at that.
Yeah.
But it's almost like learning a foreign language. And I haven't spoken wild turkey, as silly as that sounds, in quite a few years. And so I've almost lost the capacity to do it.
You didn't just get handed eggs. You'd wanted them for a long time, right?
That's right. I just had this opportunity. Somebody brought me two clutches of these wild turkey eggs that the nests had been destroyed by tractors mowing through the woods. And I said, okay, I'm going to do this. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
young people who have seen that movie are so inspired by your experience and ask you, how did you do it? What do you say to them?
I get asked this question a lot. You know, how do I do what you do? And it's very difficult. When I was in college, you couldn't study ethology. That's what I do. I'm an ethologist. And what that is a person who studies animal behavior in a natural setting. I don't use cages or any type of enclosure. And so my objective is to observe animal behavior and intelligence and consciousness in its most natural form. And up until very recently, that was not an area of academics that a person could go into. And now that's changing in biology. But when I was in college, if you wanted to study animal behavior, you went into behavioral psychology and studied rudimentary Pavlovian concepts having to do with stimulus and response and habituation. And it really didn't lend much insight into true animal behavior and consciousness.
Did you experience joy and the sort of sense of love and protection when these little turkeys hatched?
Absolutely. It's like being around any newborn animal. You know, I think biologically we're predisposed to have a parental response to a young animal. And it's precisely that response that I think lends the most insight to an observer, that you actually fall in love with these little creatures like a parent. And as a result, your interest becomes almost obsessive. And if you've observed a new mother with a child, you notice that she almost can't take her eyes off that creature. And that's the way it is with a young animal that you've imprinted. You have this incredible fascination and empathy. And every little subtle nuance is suddenly very fascinating.
From watching My Life as a Turkey, it seemed that your turkeys were so smart, and yet all my life people have said turkeys are stupid.
Well, that's a sad thing, and you know, they've bred the domestic turkey to almost pathetic, grotesque creatures. And while turkeys are very, very different, and they are incredibly intelligent and very sensitive, and they're social creatures, and they have this ability to relate and to learn. You know, I use the word consciousness a lot in my research because that's essentially what I study is not just animal intelligence, but their consciousness, you know, their experience of the world and their experience of you and their ability to learn how the universe works around them.
You have said that you think it is selfish and arrogant for the human species to think that we alone possess that kind of consciousness and that you, in fact, saw this in your turkeys.
We have no privileged access to reality. Consciousness is almost biologically mandated. You know, you have to have this conscious will to survive, and that's this razor's edge. Consciousness is being awake on the planet, just being awake. And while creatures, out of absolute necessity, have to be totally awake, totally alert, they have to be ready. They have to be actually willing to think about things. All creatures, out of absolute necessity, have to experience some level of consciousness just to maintain their existence.
You've even said that the wild turkeys you lived with had problem solving intelligence. How so?
Well, they were far more intelligent than me, in a sense.
Yeah.
They understood, almost without exception, every plant and every animal. And the specificity of that knowledge was stunning. They knew every insect. They knew if it was edible. They knew if it was dangerous. And so not only did they know these plants and these animals, but in many cases they had specific vocalizations to describe these. And so I would hear a certain vocalization from a turkey or several turkeys, and I would know without question not only had they found a snake, but I would know exactly what species of snake they had found. And so I would walk right past a large diamondback rattlesnake coiled in some blackberries, and the turkeys would immediately notify me that I had done something really stupid.
Yeah. Is it true that wild turkeys can't be bred in captivity?
It is. Wild turkeys were almost hunted into extinction in the turn of the last century and during the Depression, you know, where there were subsistence hunters, and then there were a lot of desperate people, and they almost disappeared from the landscape.
What brought them back?
Law enforcement brought them back. States realized, federal government realized that these animals were going to have to be regulated. And so we had hunting seasons, and that's true with many species. You know, white-tailed deer were almost hunted into extinction. Now, for the most part, wild turkeys are very abundant, but it's principally because of wildlife management and that consciousness that it has to be regulated.
So how did you mother your turkeys and raise them in the wild?
My main concern was keeping them alive at night. First light in the morning, they would immediately fly down to me, and I would take them out of the cage as the sun was coming up or as it was getting light, and we would stay out all day. And then we would come in right before dark, and we would enter the cage. They would follow me in. They would fly up on their little roosting limbs, and after it got completely dark, I would literally have to sneak out of the cage so that they wouldn't fly down to the ground and try to follow me.
I remember nights like that as a mother.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. You just do what you have to do.
Right. And, of course, as with any parent, you experienced as the mother of these turkeys just how distinctive their personalities were from the get-go. Let me play this excerpt from your film where you talk about two of your turkeys that you were very fond of, one named Turkey Boy and the other one Sweet Pea.
I now know each of the birds by their character and personality as much as by their appearance. Turkey Boy is still up to his old tricks. He's always pushing his brothers and sisters around, but no one seems to mind too much. Sweet Pea still has this need for closeness. She stares motionless at me for what seems like a very long time, and it's obviously a conscious behavior. It's as though she's trying to absorb something. Being the object of such intense scrutiny by such a little thing is a very strange sensation. Turkey Boy and I we couldn't have been closer, and we couldn't have had a closer relationship.
I can't remember. Did you let him be dominant?
I did. I didn't have the right body language because I'm not really a turkey, and I don't really speak wild turkey vocabulary.
Yeah. Did turkey mothering make you swear off turkeys for Thanksgiving as a food?
Well, you know, I've gone through this incredible sort of personal evolution from being, I grew up in a hunting culture.
Yeah.
And I grew up with people that had a history of subsistence hunting. So when I was a child and a young person, I was a turkey hunter, you know, as Thoreau said, you know, you go thither at first as a hunter or fisher until at last you find the seeds of a higher life and go forth as a poet or naturalist he may be and leave the gun and fish pole behind. And I'm sort of paraphrasing there. But anyway, that was sort of my development.
Now you are wrapping up your life with the mule deer of Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
9 winters with mule deer, is that right?
It's hard to believe, but yes, I have. I've spent 9 years with mule deer, literally almost without exception, every day for 9 years I've been with these animals. And the more I watch, the more incredibly complex they become.
When you're living among the mule deer, do you have to cope with hunters during hunting season in Wyoming?
Well, of course. It's a very difficult thing that I have to navigate through because I become, of course, very attached to these sensitive, intelligent, affectionate creatures that I have intimate relationships with. I've known these deer since in many cases since the day they were born, and I know them for 7, 8, 9 years in some cases. I've lost deer, in the last few years that I grieve over. You know, I think about them constantly, and I miss them.
You had an awful encounter with one of your more beloved mule deer, where you were accidentally gored.
I did. I had an unfortunate encounter with a mule deer just 2-3 nights ago. One of these bigger bucks, he's probably 6-7 years old. I've known him since he was a spotted fawn. He's just a real good friend of mine, if I could put it that way. We have a very close relationship. I would trust him with my life. In fact, I do every day. Well, he got his antler caught in my sleeve of my shirt.
Mm.
And he just panicked and exploded, and I got gored really bad in inside of my elbow, and about a 4 or 5 inch gash, and probably nicked a little artery in there. And of course, I'm standing there bleeding, and he was far more upset than I was, because he knew that he'd hurt me, but he didn't understand what had happened. And so I spent probably 15 or 20 minutes trying to convince him that he hadn't done anything wrong. He was kind of pitiful. He was so upset.
Oh, my gosh. You could tell he was upset at injuring you.
Oh, he absolutely could not understand why we had had some sort of negative encounter. And I'm standing there bleeding almost profusely and trying to assure this 300-pound buck that he did not do anything wrong, and that everything was fine, and that we were still buddies. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, he relaxed, and his ears dropped down, and his eyes softened, and he very, very slowly walked back up to me. He was almost contrite.
Are you going to be okay?
I'm fine, sure. Yeah, I've got a big hole in my arm. But, yeah, I'm just fine.
I'm so grateful for the work that you've done.
Oh, thank you.
And it revolutionizes our understanding of fellow creatures.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Joe Hutto is a naturalist, author, and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. His most recent book is The Light in High Places. A naturalist looks at Wyoming wilderness, Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, cowboys, and other rare species. Here's some turkey trivia. Did you know the turkeys we buy at the grocery store are all the white-feathered kind? It's strange because if you Google turkey, what comes up are pictures of those dark-feathered turkeys that we all drew pictures of in grade school. So how did we come to eat only white turkeys? With good reason, assistant producer Lilia Fuchin traveled to a free-range turkey farm where she learned how the so-called bronze turkey went out of fashion decades ago.
Here in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Central Virginia, I've come to visit an organic turkey farmer.
A female turkey goes, oh, 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 and the male turkey goes, It's only the male turkeys that gobble, not the female turkeys.
This is Paul Kelly, the British owner of this 100-acre farm that's now the first North American branch of the Kelly Bronze Company. And Judd Culver is the local farmer here.
Hey, gobble, gobble, gobble. Hey.
These guys love turkeys. And this farm is unique because they're raising free-range bronze turkeys. Bronze turkeys are the dark-feathered birds we usually associate with turkey. And even though these were brought here from Britain, they're actually native to the Americas.
Every turkey in the world originally was bronze in feather and came from Mexico. It's the old, slow-growing bronze breed.
The Kelly Bronze motto is bred to be wild. So these turkeys live in the great outdoors. They roost in trees at night, and they can fly.
They normally like to run before they fly, because they are kind of big and bulky, right? So if a predator comes, they will take off running. And then if they have to, then they'll fly.
So why is a British guy bringing the bronze turkey back to the U.S.? Paul explains that it's because the bronze turkey has pretty much disappeared from the market. And this started back in the 1950s. As a result of factory farming, people were getting more and more removed from their food sources. And they started to get really turned off by these little pin feathers that were left in the turkey's skin after plucking.
The whole reason the bronze turkey disappeared back in the 1950s was because of the little black feather stub in the skin.
And grocery stores wanted a cleaner look for their customers.
That bronze feather seemed to be unsightly. and the up-and-coming supermarkets wanted a really nice pearly white skin for the plastic bags. Frozen was fashionable. And the bronze turkey literally went out of fashion all in the space of 5 or 6 years, purely for aesthetics.
It turns out the white turkeys people have been buying in grocery stores for the past 60 years have the very same pin feathers. They're just harder to see.
The white turkey's got exactly the same amount of feather quills, but of course it's a white pigment. You don't see it.
Do we end up eating those?
You do.
We do.
But when you're eating a white turkey, you're eating them anyway. It's good protein. Look at it that way. We call it designer stubble. That's what we call it.
In 1971, Paul's father was disillusioned with the industrial poultry business, and the bronze turkeys were practically becoming extinct. So it was a radical move when Paul's parents started raising bronze turkeys. Like heirloom vegetables and flowers, these turkeys are from a pretty old, sturdy genetic stock. But that's not the only thing that's different about this Kelly Bronze turkey farm. They hand process each turkey by dry plucking them and then aging the birds before Thanksgiving customers come to pick them up.
In England, we call it New York dressed. We're dry plucking them by hand and hanging them, as you would a pheasant. Turkey's a game bird and it should be hung, before preparing it for the oven. It's nothing new. What we're doing actually is very, very old. It's nothing new at all. It's just tradition to the extreme.
Judd says that another important factor is timing. They let the turkeys reach sexual maturity before harvesting, rather than harvesting them at a certain weight.
We grow these guys sexual maturity, they have tons of fat. I mean, sexual maturity, like any animal, is when you start to get fat, right? So, I mean, it's part of the profile.
Because our birds are so mature, there's a lot of fat marbling running through the meat, and fat conducts the heat through the muscle tissue quicker, so it will cook in twice the time.
When it comes to cooking the turkey, Paul has one word of advice.
Please don't brine it. Just plain roast it, 2 to 2.5 hours, and you'll have an amazing Thanksgiving feast.
For more information on the Bred to be Wild Kelly Bronze Turkey Farm in Greenwood, Virginia, go to kellyturkeys.co.uk. Wow. For With Good Reason, I'm Lilia Fukin.
Next up for you, a poetic send-off. College students everywhere are packing up and heading home for Thanksgiving. But before his class is dismissed, one professor likes to entertain his students with a poem he writes especially for them. Here is mechanical engineering professor Jay Sullivan of Virginia Military Institute reading a Thanksgiving tale about one of his students who tried to invent a new turkey cooking device.
One Thanksgiving furlough comes, cadets of all types scatter, to visit home and family and get a little fatter. Some years ago, one cadet who studied engineering went home with all his books and notes, a trait I find endearing. When the day of feasting came, he took his mom aside and told her, "Let me use my craft to cook the bird outside. I'll build a fine rotisserie with my engineering skill, and then I'll even patent it, the exothermic poultry turning mill." He set to work without a pause and cut a shaft of steel, onto which he added some bearings and a wheel. Next, he took a fan belt from his brother's girlfriend's car and joined the engine to the shaft in a manner most bizarre. The turkey then was mounted upon his great machine with snap rings at the fore and aft and roll pins in between. A charcoal fire was set beneath and all systems were go as the turkey started cooking from the charcoal's orangey glow. Our cadet then flipped a switch to start the engine turning and threw the fan belt to the shaft to keep the bird from burning. Oh dear, what happened next, I say? My poor old heart beseeching. Was it engineering in youth's hands simply overreaching? Or maybe worse yet still, the wreckage of my earnest teaching? You see, my cadet, his name withheld for reputation, had neglected the effects of mass coupled with gyration. The turkey, being rather large when brought up to full speed, ripped apart quite handily at 37 G's. Turkey parts were scattered wide, and no one got to eating, as everyone was full of ire and words not for repeating. My cadet recovered, his self-esteem intact, and now he's a consultant making thousands at a crack. So what's the moral of this tale? I really couldn't say. Let's end it now, and off you go. Enjoy Thanksgiving Day. There you go. There you go.
That's a fond, poetic salute goodbye from Professor Jay Sullivan, who teaches mechanical engineering to students at Virginia Military Institute. Nature support for With Good Reason is provided by the Shia Khan Foundation and by the University of Virginia Health System, a National Cancer Institute-designated cancer center, researching and developing the treatments of tomorrow. UVAHealth.com. Support also comes from the law firm of McGuire Woods. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik, Allison Quantz, Lilia Fuchin, and John Last are our associate producers. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Miranda Bennett and Sharina Ong are our interns. Visit us at withgoodreasonradio.org or download the podcast on iTunes. To reach us, call 877-451-5098. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Anderson Coleman, bringing you classic blues and R&B on 89.3 FM. Come and enjoy the renaissance of blues with a feeling Saturdays, 8 to 10 p.m. on WHFR. You will hear great artists from B.B. King to ZZ Hill. It's a feel-good thing.
Attention licensed practical nurses. Are you looking for a convenient way to earn your RN degree? Do you need the flexibility of a program who recognizes you for your previous hard work as an LPN? Here's great news. Henry Ford College has exactly what you're looking for with their Advancement LPN to RN Bridge program. You can advance your career and become a licensed registered nurse. Want more info? Give us a call at our School of Health and Human Services at 313-845-9877. That's 313-845-9877.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
It's our commitment to classical from midnight until 10 a.m. right here on 89.3 FM. If you're listening and hearing classical programming during the 10 a.m. to midnight time frame, well, know that we are recruiting and training and educating a new student broadcaster. We are a teaching and learning institution, and we've got some people on the way that are going to provide some amazing programming just for you during these daytime hours. So stay tuned and keep listening. If you'd like more information, simply go to...